I'm very pleased to welcome back my guest today to the Old Gray Mayors podcast. He was a three-term counselor for the City of Waterloo. During his last two terms, he was chair of the Finance Committee. Today, we're going to have a good conversation about all things municipal financial. I want to welcome back Jeff Henry to the Old Gray Mayors podcast. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be back.
Listen, how is Kate and Finn? How are they all doing?
Oh, I think we're weathering the winter blues so far. You know, you get these waves of sickness that come through schools, and we're just hopefully coming off one right now. So,
well, say hi to Kate for me. And I have to say, ever since the last podcast, when I learned you were working in planning, I think was it IBI that you're with.
Yeah, now Arcatus.
I saw that because I use IBI for the odd thing, and I saw the different name change. And so every time I see anything in the newspaper where there's a presentation on some planning idea, I'm looking to see who's the planner that's involved, because I'm waiting to see if it's your name, especially if it's some innovative project that's going on in town.
And there are two of those, but that's not what we're talking about today. I've been in the paper a couple of times.
But just saying that it's always interesting for me to see. And I'm glad, you know, and I'm glad you're involved in planning, because I think you're someone that has a lot of creative ideas. And if you can't do it on behalf of the municipality, at least you're doing it on behalf of the community in this private context.
You see different sides of the table, and I think it's always enlightening to see different sides of it.
Well, the nice thing is you bring that perspective of having been on the municipal side of the table, so you have an understanding or appreciation for what's going on behind closed doors, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So the last time we were chatting, we were talking about Northdale and that project, and that was really a first-term project for you, Northdale, correct?
First term, first meeting, first day. Yeah, right out of the gate.
Okay, right out of the gate. Sometimes I'm talking to people like Melissa Durrell, and we're talking about a park that took 5 or 6 years to get wound up. But you were right into it, full deep in right away.
Yeah, I think as we talked about, 18 months from start to finish to get a plan in place, and then, you know, years in actually implementing it. And I think that's what we're getting into.
Yeah. So that's the thing that I wanted to bring up, because I've had some recent conversations, and we talk about capital plans or forecasts and budgets, and you've got the one side of the sheet that shows all these great things you like to do, but then there's the other side of the sheet that shows how's it going to be funded, right? That's that other side of the equation that sometimes people don't think about, and that's what moves things down the line sometimes.
Yeah. And in Northdale's case, one of the biggest challenges you have when you're effectively upzoning a 1950s suburban neighborhood into allowing 12 stories and a lot more density, which, boy, do we need additional housing around universities these days. It's you've got old infrastructure. It's 70 years old now. If it's still on the ground, and it was sized for the use of the day, which were, you know, bungalows on large lots rather than, you know, 6 and 12 story apartment buildings. So one of the first challenges that, you know, we had to grapple with during the planning, but then in the aftermath was, what do you do with that? How do you make sure that you've got water and sewer and modern stormwater infrastructure, not 1950s stormwater infrastructure, but modern infrastructure to deal with when it rains a lot?
Let me just, I just want to make sure the listeners understand this. So we're talking about a lot that has a single home, maybe likely three bedroom. And now on that same lot, you're looking to put, are you a 5 to 6 story building?
Or up to 12, depending on where you were heading. You put a couple of lots together and you convert 3 units.
Yeah. All these bathrooms, all these sinks, all that stuff, showers, everything else, just multiply many times over from what was originally anticipated 70 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the cautions I was given early on in the Northdale process was that the infrastructure may not be able to handle it. So in parallel with the Northdale work, we've been doing some broader master planning on water and sanitary and storm, and finding some bottlenecks in the city to growth, where you want to be able to put growth, but the pipes couldn't support that. Right. And so council unlocked a few of those projects by borrowing against development charges, you know, future contributions from developers from growth to pay for growth, to advance some of those bottlenecks. But that wasn't going to solve, you know, that on this lot in the middle of the neighborhood, the pipe from the main trunk up to there wasn't large enough. So the innovative approach that we'd taken here, recognizing it was going to take a couple of decades to go in and fully upgrade the Northdale neighborhood, was to allow developers, when they come in, to extend and upsize the particular infrastructure they needed up to their lot, right? So from wherever it was fine up to where they were building. And right. So we had maybe a dozen projects in total that upfronted the cost of those infrastructure upgrades so that they could be serviced and they could be built, because the plan said we should build it, the demand says we should build it, but the water supply or the sanitary supply said, you know, there's pipes too small and needed some work. And I think what was really curious about this one was, you know, typically when you let somebody advance the timing of your infrastructure by right. paying for it, when you get to actually replacing it, you know, 2, 5, 10 years down the road, you'd pay them back for the work. But the city, we're going to have the money for that at the time. We said, no, if you want to go now, you pay. We're not reimbursing you. And as I said, a dozen projects advanced that infrastructure for us.
Yeah, and that really. That kind of like blew my mind a bit from a municipal knowledge base perspective. I totally understand where you're coming from, because I think I find sometimes councillors don't show enough maybe backbone, pushback, courage when dealing with developers to take this more aggressive stance, negotiating stance, because at the end of the day, developers want to build in, like, for example, Waterloo. Who doesn't want to build in Waterloo? You know, Waterloo itself, to be able to build in Waterloo is almost like an asset itself that you can push back to builders and say, oh, look, this is what you got to do. If you're not going to do it, someone else will come by and do it. So I commend you for that approach.
Yeah. And the trade-off from that is, you know, you might be cutting into a road several times. Every new project might cut a little bit further, And so there are some disruptions to that.
Right.
And it means that on a street like Albert Street, where that's being done, heading up from University Avenue up the hill on a number of projects, well, now it's being, you know, surfaced on top of it. It's got the key piece of infrastructure underneath it. And so in terms of the decision for when does the city come along and reconstruct that road, put in the separated bike lanes, give the wider sidewalks and the pedestrian lighting, all the stuff that came from our Northdale Streetscape plan, well, that gets pushed out, because when you run it through the decision support system for asset management, we'll talk about later today, it comes out near the bottom. It's like, you know what? Your underground's fine, so we don't need to do the top.
Right, right, and that was the LRT thing.
Projects ahead of you, yeah.
That was the LRT thing, replacing all that underground infrastructure that was, you know, corduroy roads and everything else that got discovered. But a lot of that infrastructure was old.
Yeah, I remember the Victorian water pipe that we replaced in King Street South. I say Victorian era because Queen Victoria was on the throne when it went in, and it wasn't caught. That one wasn't caught. Because it was just outside the project limits, but as soon as Grand Link got in there, you excavate some stuff, you look at this pipe, and you say, guys, we're kind of worried that if we construct here, that's going to break. So do you want to add to our scope of work and we'll replace it for you? And, you know, the city and the region talk, and we said, it was an 1880s pipe. We'd lined it at some point in the 1980s, but it could crack. There was a risk. Why not replace a Victorian era pipe with something from the 21st century?
So on this Northdale approach, then, the alternative would have been borrowing against future development charges, DC's development charges, that builders would be paying every time they're ready to build on a lot.
Well, yeah, if we were trying to really advance a whole bunch of roadwork, we'd have had to go into debt. There wasn't enough money. And you borrow against the potential for future growth, your forecasted future growth. But when that growth comes, you don't know, right? Anything could happen, as we've learned over the last decade. Anything can happen.
Yeah. Slow down and building, right? Yeah. Slow down and building. Now, best laid plans are impacted because the buildings isn't being constructed as you had hoped, projecting out into future years.
Yeah. So the one road we went ahead with, you know, Spruce Street and the outlet on Hickory to King, we did because that was a major bottleneck, particularly for stormwater. for not just Northdale, but also the neighborhood to the north of it, there were some flow problems. And Spruce Street was also the most built up already in terms of being developed. So it made sense to go first because you weren't going to cut into it 16 more times. And so that went first. You got to see what the new streetscapes are going to look like. But that was a piece the city had to advance because it was substantial. You're not going to get somebody to pay for 15 meters of your massive trunk storm sewer.
Yeah. So, when you talk about Albert Street from University, you talk like University to Columbia, Albert Street along that route,
yeah,
for example.
Heading up the hill. Yeah.
So, and I can remember back in the day, like I'm talking early 80s, when my friends were living in those homes going to Laurier, right? Now that is just transformed, well, I'd say tremendously in terms of what's there now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a huge change to the skyline. But that was one sort of way that we had to deal with paying it. And the rest, you know, over the 20 years, all the roads will eventually get done. They'll get done in the usual way, funded partly by development charges and partly by regular capital dollars, because it's not all about growth, right? Some of that's just like fixing what you've got. You can't use development charges for. It's only the growth portion. So there's a split, and that'll happen over the course of the next 10, 15 years.
What was the reception like when you said, you know, we're not paying you back?
I don't know. I never heard anything about it. So I can tell you that, right? Nobody started calling counselors and saying, what are you people doing? I think everybody was ready to grow and ready to go. And they accepted that as a way of advancing a project many years. And the numbers, from what I saw on the agreements that came back, these were five figures, not six figures. So
work to be done wasn't in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, the tens of thousands. And it was it was acceptable.
I don't want to call it a rounding error, but on a $30 million development project, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 isn't large in the grand scheme of things.
No, that's right. So that's why you wouldn't get that sort of that sort of pushback. And that was the issue too. I mean, you were a bit forewarned by the mayor of the day that, hey, don't get your hopes up on the Northdale plan, for example.
Yeah, turns out we could be creative and solve the infrastructure problem over time, right? It's you can deal with part of it and just keep dealing with it rather than, you know, be stymied by not having a full solution on day one.
I think that speaks to, too, bringing on new people from time to time under council and coming up with these innovative ideas and testing. You know, why can't we do it this way, right? Just asking that why question.
Yeah, absolutely. Most important question in politics and in life.
So just on the capital, yes. Sometimes you don't want to hear your kids always asking why, but you'll wait. You'll hear that from Finn in the future. But anyway,
that's not in the future. But that's how you learn, right?
Yeah. So just on the whole capital concept, then, in terms of that capital forecast, the funding is always the biggest issue in terms of trying to figure out where that's going to come from. And we're limited. I mean, we're always hopeful that we're going to receive, you know, by good grace, grants from our higher levels of government, money they take from us that sits in their coffers. And then they decide what programs they're going to support when they dole it back to us.
Yeah, no, and being able to fund capital projects is takes a lot of work and a lot of planning. And I think most people don't appreciate, and the media often doesn't appreciate, and so doesn't reflect it well, the difference between your day-to-day operating budget and your capital budget, right? It's like, how much does it cost to pay your water bill, operating budget, versus replacing your water heater, your capital budget, right, in your home?
And so
your property tax calculation, like the revenue calculation for the city, property taxes, user fees, some grants, you know, most of that money is for the operating needs, the day-to-day, you know, running the city, recreation programs, library transfers, staffing for all these things, doing basic maintenance and day-to-day activities. But you're also putting a chunk of that money aside into various capital reserve funds so that you can save up enough money to do projects. As you know, operating budget looks about the same year one to year two to year three to year four. You might tweak some things. But you're doing the same stuff for the most part. But a capital budget is like building a new arena. It doesn't come along every day. That's choppy, right? You save up money for 10 years, you pay for it for the 10 years afterwards too. And it's this huge hit in 1 year. So these reserve funds are designed to help smooth out your ability to fund those things and to plan. And so that's the capital versus operating.
Yeah, and that's what I found is I had this conversation with John Gazzola. We were talking about the center and the square and the operating side of it. And he said one of the problems was that, you know, they ran into difficulties when council wouldn't provide them sufficient funds for those capital projects to not, you know, we're not talking about building it, we're talking about maintaining it. And so now you're dipping into operating funds because there's some in significant infrastructure capital improvements or replacements that you have to do just to keep the facility operating.
And yeah, nobody cut a ribbon for replacing a chiller. Nobody cut a ribbon for shaving and paving the road. But you put something new and shiny in, well, those will attract some attention.
Yeah,
some
brass money,
and you'll have your MP in from Ottawa. Everybody will be ready to cut that ribbon.
Drop the check. Okay, see you later. Now we're stuck figuring out how to get it all done. You know, this gets back to my view about when I was talking about one city, and we're not going to get into that, but the importance, I think we'll both agree the importance of cities in terms of dealing with all of these programs from the other levels of government, whatever they may be. You know, for example, international students, bringing in more international students, the cities in Waterloo region has to deal with the fallout of all of that in terms of housing, food insecurity, all those other things that come with that. And we only have the limited property tax base. I know you mentioned user fees, but that's such a small, that's the tip of the tail of the dog.
Well, and user fees include at the local level the water utility rates, right? So I mean, you look at the city split of the budget, about 40% of it might be property taxes, about 40% of it might be water, wastewater, stormwater fees, and the other 20% are other kinds of user fees, some grants that you occasionally get, like the gas tax fund or the Canadian Community Building Fund or whatever it's called tomorrow, and. And maybe interest off of some investments municipality is able to make off of the money that it's not currently using because it's sitting in the reserve fund and waiting for the big capital project. And so you know, at budget time, right, you get a lot of focus on the operating budget. But the water utility budget, right, is considerable in size and the rate changes are about the same. But you don't focus much on that because you have to do it. And on the operating budget, you're like, do we really need to spend an extra 2% to be able to? No, I don't know if we need if we need to add a little bit more to maintain the road. What do you mean we added 3 new parks? We got to maintain 3 new parks? We won't include that.
It's like an arena. Build an arena. Now you got to operate it. Now you got all the heating, cooling costs, chilling costs, whatever, all those costs that come with it. And that leads to the discussion about, this concept called infrastructure deficit.
Yeah. No, it's, when I showed up on council, I remember hearing a presentation at budget time about, you know, you've looked out, there's this 10-year forecast of projects that you're approving in principle, right? You approve the year that you're budgeting, but then the next 9 years, this is what we think we'll be doing. But the staff are saying, well, the gap between what we've got in the plan and what we know needs to be done is over this 10 years is $150 million. So that's our infrastructure gap. 100? Wow. What? That, yeah. Okay. Okay. First year. What do I do about that? Find out more. Like what? Okay.
Well, hold on. Wait, before you get to that, what's a 1% property tax increase? How much money does that generate?
When I started about $650,000, and when I finished closer to $800,000 over those 12 years.
So not even a million bucks, right? So
so $150,000 over 10 years, $15 million a year. That's 25%?
Right,
So like that's sort of the number. And then the next year, the number was higher, right? It turns out old stuff keeps getting older, and there's more of it coming due the longer you kick the can down the road. And I think council as a whole was, you know, some members were like, this problem's too big. The number changes all the time. I don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it. We'll just keep doing what we can do.
Yeah.
And just sort of head in the sands and deal with that. But by the end of the first term, councillor being convinced by staff to fund. Let's start looking at this asset management challenge that we've got in more detail. Let's go out and really drill down on it to understand it, to get some really solid numbers on what it is, what's causing it, how we can forecast it better, how we can plan better, how we can manage this better, and also to sell council on funding it better. So we approved that in the first year, and in the first term. And so when I was going into my second term, I knew this was going to be a problem. I knew this was something I wanted to tackle. People generally don't run on, as I said, the ribbon cutting on shaving and paving a road or replacing a chiller. But I made it one of two things that I talked about in that first reelect to say we need to have an affordable and sustainable plan to renew our infrastructure. So
just,
that
Jeff, just
your
before
kids
you,
have the same
Jeff,
stuff my kids do. Right?
Just before you get on to that, I just want to double check. When you said approved, what was approved in the first term?
We approved some capital funding. I don't know, it was a couple $100,000 for staff to go secure some consultants, to build some systems, to do some work, some people onto the project
so you needed more information. To understand what was going on. Okay.
Yeah. And so that staff came up with that. That seemed prudent to me. I was starting to understand the size of the problem. And it's like, okay, let's get more information. Let's understand this. Because for council to choose to fund something, you have to know what kind of difference it's going to make.
Right.
You can't, if it's a big black box, throwing more money into the big black box is not exactly higher on your priority list, unless you know the outputs are going to be something you can tell people is better for them and it was worthwhile to do, right?
And you had no answers to those questions at that point.
No, I didn't, no idea what it was going to be, but I knew that we were going to need something. And I thought it would be helpful to have run on trying to solve a problem. So if you have to make a hard vote later, you can go back and point and say, look, I said we were going to try to solve this. This is one of the reasons I said I wanted to come back, was to work on this. Now I'm working on it. Here it is.
So how did that process go with the consultants?
So it was interesting. Staff actually invited me in to sit with the RFP review process. So I got to take a look at the bid submissions and the rest as that had got scoped up, which isn't typical, but I think they saw a potential champion around the council table and keep a guy that wants information engaged and you'll get better outcomes.
Well, the finance chair is a good champion for this particular issue.
this was, and they'd seen the municipal staff watch campaigns, right? They know what people are saying out there.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out how things are going to work in the next council term.
That's a whole thing in itself. Staff trying to figure out what's the bits and bytes? What did they pull up in their hand for the next term?
Yeah. What's coming? Yeah. So, I mean, I started going to some conferences. AMO, the Association of Municipalities Ontario, was running on asset management. There were some leaders in the field at the time that had done a few things. I think Thunder Bay had done some work. There were some municipalities out east in the Atlantic provinces that had done some work. And I remember one of those sessions. They'd put a graph on screen of here was our current state, right? Over the next 10, 15 years, it was okay, and it was going to become really bad, right? And you could sort of see the color change in your mix of assets in good condition and assets in poor condition, and assets in very poor condition. And then they said, so here's the investment choice that we provide council, and here's the change to the graph. So I pulled over our general manager of infrastructure services or public works, or the titles changed after that. But I said, we need that. Council needs to see that. Like the end output of this has to be something that graphically we can tell council where we're at, where we're going, and what happens if we do different things. So that you can see the change.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to physically wrap your head around the $2 billion in assets the city runs and say, haha, I see it. But you can see it in graphical form as you get less bad and more good. Showing up also, from your change in investment.
Yeah. So over time, things change for sure. But I guess you also get an idea on the extent of the dollar number you're talking about. When we talk about infrastructure deficit, it's the cost to replace infrastructure and how are we funding that? So did you have an idea on that number when you were getting into this at the start?
Well, I didn't, but I'll tell you one thing and then I'll tell you the answer to that. Yeah. first thing is the output of this that the consultant sort of built with us was something we call a decision support system. It basically took all the inputs of what we know about our assets, all the stuff we're doing to our assets, right? Whether it's fixing a pothole, whether it's sort of going and doing a maintenance repair on something, whether it's replacing a roof. So you could build that all into a collective system. And based on, you know, either industry standard practice for depreciation, right? It's like how long before you have to replace it? How long before you have to do these operations? There are many standard operating procedures for a lot of infrastructure assets for how that works. Age-based, condition-based, all those. You plug all that in and you can get a 25-year forecast of these are the investments that are due at this time. And then you add them up, right? And you could look at our current financial plan, right? What was in the forecast? What are the budgeted funding levels for infrastructure in transportation, infrastructure in recreation? Apply those to what's coming up and see what the deficit is, right? And see what happens when you don't make that investment and have those sort of kick down the count. So we had a system that would forecast all of that for you. And if you tweak the inputs, if you say, what happens if we put a 2% escalator, if we increase the amount we're spending by 2% every year, what does that look like? Right? What if it's 5% every year? What if it's, right? What if we focus on these assets? What do we focus on those? And you could pull down very granular into very subtype, into very small subsets of our asset pool of our $2 billion in assets and see the effect of making certain investments. And so the first example of this that I'd sort of show where we could use this, the federal government had come up with a program of water, right? Improving water infrastructure around the country. These are big, expensive things. And our stormwater assets, our stormwater ponds in particular, right? They need to be cleaned out about every 10 to 15 years. Our funding meant we could clean them out every 175 years.
Okay. Yeah.
175? Right. 10 to 15.
Yeah.
So the feds came through, they had some funding, so we could do about five ponds. And you could see you could see what was happening in the graph from making that investment. And we could sort of show, this is what the feds grant for us did to our infrastructure profile. You can show that back to them to say, see what impact you're having? They love that.
Yeah.
but you know, we're funding more and, you know, we're increasing stormwater rates to get to a sustainable level to replace this. But what it did was on the stormwater ponds, it accelerated our path to balance, our path to not having that deficit by about 5 years, that federal investment. And we could model that, show that, and see that, you know, instead of it happening, us getting there in 2036, I'm going to make up a number, we get there in 2027.
Right. I hope you added a ribbon cutting with the feds on that.
We were in City Hall. I remember that. I still have photos. Nothing very sexy to show. You don't really want to show the muck that comes out of those ponds when you're cleaning them out.
I understand. Yeah, but so that is brilliant. I mean, to be able to have that to show. Now, the federal government, so you're, like you said, how many stormwater ponds did you have? I was just curious.
I think that one funded 5 or 6. I don't remember the number that we have. It's 20, 30, 30, like, but it accelerated our program significantly.
Let me ask you this, though. So the other thing, though, too, is when you're trying to forecast, you're also considering the, like, we'll say, like, level of service or level of repair. And I remember when I was mayor and we had a consultant, everyone was required to bring in a consultant who took a look at your assets and said whether they were like an A, B, C, D or E grade and what you had to do to get them up. And like for road repair, it was like digging out the road and a base of 8 inches of this and 5 inches of that. And we were in the shave and pave reality. That's all I knew at the time.
Yeah, so two things on that, because that was actually one of my intros in the first term to understanding the infrastructure cycle, right? Because everybody can get a road, right? Because you all drive over them or walk beside them and hear drivers cursing about the potholes. Everybody sees that. But like a road can last you 50 years, right? If you build it right, you maintain it right, you can last 50, 60 years. But the way you treat those roads, the first thing that you'll start to do, you'll start to see cracks in a new road show up. So you got to seal those cracks.
Yep.
Then you'll start to see potholes appearing where some of those cracks sort of hit the side and they grow a little bit.
Right.
And so you got to seal those pieces. And after about 25 years, your road is in a state that you shave and pave it. You take the top layer off. Maybe there's some repairs to the bottom. Spot clean, and then you put a new coat on and you go through the cycle again, you know, seal the cracks, do the other piece. And then when you get to 50 years, then you got to dig the whole thing out because the base has failed. The stuff underneath the top layer of the road has failed. And if you just shave and pave on top of it, it'll crumble very quickly because the base has failed underneath it. Water's getting in and up and your lifespan is a lot less. And so the way you keep a road going is you do the treatments when you need to do the treatments. You've got enough money in your annual maintenance budget to seal the cracks as they open. You've got enough money at year 20 to 25 to shave and pave the road. And then it lasts long enough. Whereas if you don't do that, your base is going to fail by year, I don't know, 30 rather than year 50.
Right.
And shaving and paving on top isn't going to solve your problem. You need to go all the way down. And so I had some circumstances in neighborhoods where, you know, a neighborhood built in the 1950s, 1960, you can tell by the number on the sewer grate, right? What year that was put in.
Right. Yep. Yep.
And you're going around your neighborhood and you want to know. They're like, well, my road's so bumpy, you need to fix it. I said, you need a total redo. And we have 10 roads for every one road we are funding for right now. So I'm sorry, you're not at the top of the list. Yeah. They don't like to hear that, especially when the house is $2 million. They really don't like me saying that. But the neighborhood over, whose streets were built in the late 70s or early 80s, the city's gone in and they've done a shave and pave. Why? Because we started to put more infrastructure money in. Yeah. And if you make the investment at the right time, our model could show that's how you extend the life of the assets. That was your best funding was at that 2025 year mark, save the base by doing the top. Like, why are they getting the new road? They had one. I've been here for that. You know, the system is optimizing the investments because we all know there's not enough money. And so you got to put it where it makes the most good and the most. And so I had lots of angry people when I knocked on that door in the neighborhood. Why am my road not getting done? Well, our system says our optimal investment is to do it over here.
And it's complicated. You can't see underneath what's going on. I guess one way to know who your local councillor is the person that's with their head down looking at dates on grates.
That's a way to find out, right?
So
that's an example, right? And our decision support system won national and provincial awards on things for the ability to look at all these components together and optimize investments. The second term gave us that, right? And we still didn't fund more money.
I was going to say, you hear about the problem. Now you get a better picture on the problem and you're getting an idea what the cost of it is. So how do you fund that? That's the next part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, and you'd said originally, what was the number what you expected? Well, the numbers I told you at the beginning, when we were only looking at 10 years rather than average over 25 years, they were about right. Like staff were pretty good with the data we had at giving us the right number. You divide that sort of $225 million in that second year by 10, about 22 and a half a year. That's almost exactly where our decision support system model landed at the time based on, and things have gone up from there because construction costs have ballooned and you've added some more data that we didn't ever have before.
Yeah, we're talking post-COVID, supply chain, inflation. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah,
we had projects coming in 30 to 70% over, and that was just industry. And so that's harder to model. So things are worse now, but they're better than they would have been. And that's the hardest sell in politics.
But things are better than the funding. How do you fund it? How did you fund it?
Yeah. So we had the model. The first thing that we did, because everybody said, I want you to spend every dollar you have wisely, is we did a whole review of our capital reserves, right? And our reserve fund policies, so that we were able to optimize the number and balance of those reserves to stretch the dollars as much as we have. Because sometimes you've got minimum balances, you're forecasting for this project, but if you look at them a different way, you're like, well, we actually have $2 or $3 million more dollars than we thought to spend just by looking at the financial policies around all of those. So that's very nitty-gritty work.
Yeah.
But that was the first phase of our efforts. The second phase was council tweaked another policy that actually had come from before my time. It was the first move that council did on assets in the late 2000s was for every new dollar in growth, in assessment growth that we got, we set aside 40 cents into reserve funds rather than spend it in the operating budget. Nobody else sort of does that.
Oh.
So we started sheltering in the late 2000s, 40 cents of every new growth dollar away in the capital reserve, 20 cents in capital.
Yeah, so let's,
for funding,
let's explain
new things,
that.
And 20 cents
growth.
In reinvestment.
Yeah. Let's explain that a little bit more. I just want to say just quick, we're doing the budget. You know, it's like, it's going to be an 8% increase. And we always say, well, what's the assessment growth number? And they'll say, it's 2%. Okay, we're so great. So now we're down to, you know, from 8 to 6. But explain what that assessment growth is.
So let's pretend you've got a town of 10 houses.
Yeah.
So here's your base budget. You've got $100,000 budget, right? You're getting, I guess, $10,000 from each house. High property taxes in a small town. Yeah. But now you get a new house. So now there's 11 houses. That one new house is assessment growth, right? It's a growth in the amount of sort of assessed value in your area from an addition or a substantial change, not from just how much your value has gone up for your house, but from explicitly the fact that it's a new thing that exists. That's the growth, not about how much your house value goes up or down, but the fact that there's something new. That's the assessment growth. So now there's 11 houses. So your $100,000 budget. Well, if you have it be $110,000 and everybody's property taxes are zero, but you got $10,000 extra to spend because you got the new house paying the bill.
Yep.
So that's the easiest way to shake that down. And this lesson I had to learn very quickly because I remember in my first year on council, I just bought a house, a condo, the year I ran for council. So I knew what my interim property tax bill was. Then I passed a bunch of property tax changes. And then I saw my final property tax bill. And I'm like, hold on, I didn't raise taxes by that amount. What happened here? So I had to figure out how the system actually flows through assessment growth changes, whether your value is up or down relative to the average value, how these things get spread over a weighted assessment base. It's a bit complicated, but seeing my first ever property tax bill go from draft to final and not having it be what I thought it would be, and me being on council, I thought I should understand it.
Yes. No, since 2016, we haven't had to go through that exercise. I mean,
through a reassessment. Yeah.
Yeah, through reassessment.
Yeah. Like the average house valued at $348,000.
Uh-huh. Right. So just continue on then. Like you were just giving an example of assessment growth. And so you guys are putting aside, rather than putting that all to lowering a property tax, you use part of it to lower property taxes, but part of it to go into reserve funds.
Yeah. So we were shoving 40% away into reserve funds, half of it for building new stuff. Yeah. And half of it for replacing old stuff, right? So 20 cents for replacing old stuff to create that reserve to start doing that rehabilitation. So the other tweak that we made, right, before we talked about infrastructure levies and funding this gap, was we tweaked it from 2020 to 3010, right? So that, you know, so that we'd send a little bit more to the replace existing stuff rather than build new stuff, right? So we're trying to redirect, look at all of our different funding profiles. Yeah. How do we maximize what we're doing to deal with the gap before we ask for, increased property tax rates to help fund additional infrastructure and help close the gap. So those were all the setups that we got before that 3-year budget in my last term, which was when we had the data, we had the charts, we'd done some public engagement to really sort of show people where we were going if we didn't do something different and what the gaps were. Everybody that came to those, put their nickel in and said, that you need to fund that. Right. It was like 9-1 in favor when people saw the data.
Yeah.
We didn't get a lot of people, but we took this traveling roadshow to all the other consultations that we were running, right? Not just here's have its own, but this thing's happening and we're replacing this stuff at Rim Park. We're doing this new field or whatever. By the way, let's talk about asset management.
Yeah.
So we brought the traveling roadshow to where people were already.
Which is good.
What they thought. Yeah.
Because it's surprising how few people show up when you do budget consultations. You don't get a lot of people coming out.
I knew that wasn't going to work, right? I was pressing our team for how can we be creative, recognizing it's a very difficult thing to consult on because it's very abstract. And it's very numbers-based and driven. So that's where the visuals sort of help people.
Right.
They could get it. Right.
But let me ask you then, I mean, obviously the assessment growth piece wasn't going to be enough to fund this thing. So you got to get it from the taxpayers. So how did you get it from the taxpayers?
Yeah. And so the other thing we were doing along with this was a long-term financial plan as well. And so you could blend the two together. You could forecast your expenses and you could see what would it take to close this gap within a couple of decades.
Right? I was going to say 30 years.
Yeah. Well, if it takes 70 years to create a problem, it's going to take more than 7 minutes to solve it.
Total fair. Yes, totally fair.
And so let's look at it for a couple of decades. And the staff long-term financial plan said, we need to do 1.5% as a, whether it's a levy or whether you roll it in, you know, for about 15 years to close the gap. Yeah, every single year. Now, that didn't quite wash at the council table when we got there. As finance chair, you're trying to find a way for five hands to go up on something,
right? Five out of nine or five out of eight.
Yeah. Five out of eight. To go up, and we got seven out of eight. And I think the one hand that didn't go up was because, I should say the other part first. Council agreed to a 1%, you know, levy piece over that 3-year budget. 1%, 1%, 1%.
Yeah.
And the one vote against said, the staff report said 1.5. So I think we should do 1.5. So the vote against wasn't a vote against.
Which you would have been fine with the 1.5. You would have been fine with that. I mean, realistically, that's what it probably should be.
Yeah. And I made a speech at the time because, you know, this is what politicians do. But standing in the chair for making the argument for this, knowing that there was a discussion happening. My view isn't since, you know, municipalities have 60% of the infrastructure, but they get 10% of all the tax dollars in the country.
Right,
you've seen that number, right?
Yeah.
Most of the tax revenue is at the federal level. Most of the infrastructure is at the municipal level.
Yes.
That we can't let them off the hook. The idea of us solving this whole problem ourselves made no sense to me in a federation where these things have been downloaded six ways from Sunday and the place with some revenue was there. So this was a really good argument for, you know, doubling the gas tax from the feds or whatever the numbers were that FCM was sort of putting up. So I wanted to link it into the current FCM campaign for asking the feds for more.
Gotcha.
And what the feds ended up doing for that, you know, for 1 year of COVID was they doubled it for a year. Right. I think, or maybe it was a year before COVID, they doubled it that 1 year, but it was just temporary because they had some extra money. But if it was made permanent, that would have shaved, I think I calculated that would have shaved 4 years off of our, you know, off of our infrastructure gap forecast, just from doing that.
Definitely.
And having that be a base. And if the province was doing the same, then that would shave another 5 years and that would be the balance, right? So I didn't want us on a roller coaster that took us to solving the whole problem ourselves when it really should be shared.
No, absolutely. And that's the problem with social services, those provincial initiatives that end up on the local levy. I remember Doug Craig when he was mayor and was on I don't know if it was a large city caucus or whatever it was. And they were trying to propose, look, just give us back 1% of the taxes you take out of our community from the province or the feds. And that would be a significant amount of money that we would have back to us. Just the amount of money that's taken out of our community is tremendous and just puts such a strain on us. So, okay, so you get the 1%. Yeah. And now, though, you're capital levies seem to be a pretty common thing now with municipal budgets.
Yeah, so when we did ours, there were a few examples, right? Including in the region, I think Woolwich had done one the year before. But I don't think anybody else in the region had done one yet. But now most of the municipalities in the region of Waterloo have something. Like Cambridge just tacked one on. And, you know, Wilmot has done the, right? So there's
in North Dumfries, because 1% back then was $30,000. We did a special levy for fire, and we might have done a capital one as well. And I would just say, look, you know, it's a volunteer fire department. You want a pumper truck. This is what these things cost. And we got to start putting money aside. It's just, it's all there is to it. So,
yeah. From seeing this problem in the first term and running on solving it in the second, and then the third saying, no, now we're really going to vote for it right now that we've got all the information, this first term after I've left council, seeing that it wasn't an add-on to the budget. It wasn't you have to vote to put this in specially. It came in the base budget as the staff recommended budget. And council didn't appear, I didn't watch it closely, but council didn't really appear to be debating, upending that. It's now
not
part of
change.
The culture of we got to solve this stuff.
Right. So let's transition. Unless there's something else you want to add on this, I want to transition to the 3-year budget concept.
It's a good place to transition. I was going to try to do that myself.
Yeah. So we read in the paper, Waterloo does this 3-year budget, and it's, you know, not done anywhere else locally that I'm aware of. And so tell me about the evolution to this 3-year budget format for Waterloo.
Yeah, so I think the rules changed in the Municipal Act in about 2006 to allow this. I think that's true. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but in that first term before I came on, the CFO of the day convinced the Mayor Halloran Council that we should try this new thing. Right, we should. We've got a 4-year term, which was new then, right? It had been 3-year terms up till there. We got a 4-year term. Let's do a 1-year budget in the first year, because you show up in December, you got to have a budget like next week. So yeah, we'll do a 1-year budget that first term. We'll spend the next 6 months doing strategic planning, and then we'll build a 3-year budget. The rest of the years in the term, we'll build into one budget. We'll approve it really at the end of that first full year on council. And then now you've got a budget for the rest of the term, and we can focus staff time and council focus on.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a sec. I just want to. Yeah, we'll get to the benefits in a sec, and that's a great benefit.
So that's a 3-year budget, right? You're approved sort of 3 years at once. You debate it all at the same time. Sometimes we'll look at this and go, you know what? Can we move this forward a couple of years? Can we push this back a couple of years? And you can see it all, right? You see that whole picture. 3 years of capital spending. And then each year that in year 2 and year 3 of that 3-year budget, it's got to come back before council, and you've got to affirm it.
But I just wanted to pick up on, Jeff, before we move into it too deeply here, was just this general concept that in that first year of the term of council, it's not the 3-year budget. And I think that's a great benefit, because especially if you have new counselors coming on, just understanding the concept of a budget and what you can do and what you can't do, to be faced with a 3-year budget right off the hop would be a bit overwhelming. And at least by having that sort of that inaugural year, it's like your property taxes 101 before you got into the more advanced property tax class, which is the 3-year, is a benefit.
Absolutely. And really, you've got these 4-year strategic plans. I always got questions from folks about, so how does the budget happen, right? How do you actually get to having a budget in a municipality? Because we don't seem to be consulted on a lot of it. Like, we do. And that doesn't mean you're showing up.
That's right. Exactly. There's tons of consultation.
95% of the budget making happens on the staff side, but not in a vacuum. It happens in the context of what's council's strategic plan? What are they trying to advance and do and change in their term of council? So that'll prioritize certain things over other things. What are the base pressures for just existing as a municipality, right? What is our cost pressure? What are some of our revenue pressures? How do we model those, right? And what number does that is staff, salary, settlements, all those things. What are all the master plans, right? What does it say in the water master plan? What does it say in the recreation master plan? What does it say in the, so what do we need to advance out of those? And how do we build an operating budget? How do we build a capital program based on how much money we're seeing that aligns with all of these different plans, which have been consulted on, right? Individually.
Especially the master plans. Put them all together. Right. Those have been publicly consulted upon, and those are reflections of what the public has said. This is the type of community we want. So now we're trying to make it happen financially.
Yeah. Turn it into numbers and figure out which numbers can happen now. And, because you get these master plans and they say short term, medium term, long term, not year 1 year, 2 year, 3, for a reason, because they all got a layer on top of each other and there's only so much money.
Yeah, there's a lot of plates spinning. So how did the how did you say, OK, we're going with this 3-year plan? Talk about how that came about, and then you could talk about the benefits that you were touching on.
So the first 3-year budget happened in 2007. That was 3 years before I joined council. My understanding of that was that the CFO of the day, who was Bob Maven, had pitched it to council as a way to, it was a new tool that you could use and a way to create some efficiency with staff time, right? Like the amount of stuff that goes on, like it's a duck on water, the amount of peddling underneath that's going on with those flippers for staff to produce a budget every year. Right. Thousands of hours, right, that you sort of are spending in all the different departments and council and the public time.
Council meetings too,
So if you can do that 2 times in 4 years rather than 4 times in 4 years, that's 2 years worth of budget making in time you're saving, and you can apply it to other things. There were there was a change to accounting rules that happened in that period. Very sexy stuff, I know.
But important. Pins in the eye.
and actually, those changes to accounting rules, staff were able to change the accounting system over to manage these things without asking council for any more money, because they had 2 years of budgets they didn't have to do. Right. So they could actually focus on updating the accounting system. And if you want to talk about the infrastructure story, as I understand it, talking to our finance people, it actually started with the accounting rule change because it made certain things visible that weren't visible before.
It was more, it seemed more fuller disclosure, but you're not sure how that all came about. But anyways, magic dust that happened. But let me, but let me just say this, the while it's a 3-year budget, it's still subject to annual approvals, right?
Absolutely. So there's a policy that council adopted at the time as well that says, so when do we have to say, okay, I know we did this 3-year budget, but this isn't working, right? We got to change. And so there are some guardrails put on it, right? If assessment growth is much higher or much lower than you were expecting, that creates holes or creates surplus revenue or a gap in revenue. You got to deal with that. Maybe you got to reopen the budget. If the economy goes into a frickin' tailspin, and everything's maybe that's a good moment to. So there were a few guardrails put up, and over the years, councils opened it up a couple of times. I think once in my term early on, where the budget shrank a little bit, the property tax increase dropped, some of the allocations to departments dropped, because the circumstances changed. And then the other time that I think people were wondering if we should. It didn't tweak policy, but during COVID, right? During that first COVID, phase, right? Those first few years of COVID, before we decided to let it rip, was there was a huge hit to sort of the economic indicators. But those economic indicators were actually very brief blips, right? All the federal support propped up the economy. So it didn't trip any of the levers. The construction projects kept going. They were allowed to go. There was no assessment growth hole. So the trigger wasn't there. But council was certainly very interested in seeing what it could do on an affordability basis, given the challenges people were facing. Yeah. And so when we looked at the budget and you looked at the strategic plan, you said, all these things that were in here about equity, around closing infrastructure gaps, around trying to build a city where people can recreate outside and be together, those seem more important now than they actually did when we passed it. So hacking those doesn't make sense. The feds were supplying money to support the revenue hole we had in recreation, which was temporary. So there wasn't really anything we could do on the operating budget side that was affecting property taxes. But we'd had a good year on the utility side. So we were able to freeze utility rates rather than have them go up, which delivered probably about 40 or on our portion of it, since part of it was the region, but our portion of it would have been maybe 30 or 35 bucks. Which is sort of half of that planned rate, and would have been equivalent to slashing the property tax rate change in half, right? So we were able to deliver some savings because we were able to look at our reserves and say we're okay now, and we can spread out this deferred revenue over the next 10 years, and we'll be all right.
So there are operational benefits to the 3-year budget. Sometimes, though, there's political downfall to the 3-year budget in terms of the cumulative rate that people look at. And I'm thinking about currently where it was, over 20%. But then I thought, if you added the region's last two budgets, that was over 15%. So, It's like,
On the same day, the headline down below was showing that Cambridge had a property tax rate change that was higher than it was in Waterloo. And their next 3 years in their forecast were higher. Those didn't get totaled. Yeah. I think the political downside is all in the reporting.
I want to shift quickly because we don't have a lot of time. I want to talk about CPI and MPI.
So
a lot of times we talk about the budget and it's like it can't go above the inflation rate or the consumer price index rate. But Waterloo had a concept called the municipal price index or MPI, which was supposed to be sort of an answer to that, I guess. Why don't you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, MPI was also a CFO Bob Maven special from the 2006-2010 period, right, when the 3-year budget came in. Because then how do you forecast what you should have over that period of time? So I think this was a tool to sort of try to do that. CPI, when you think about it, is compiled by StatsCan. It's the intent of it is to look at a basket of goods that's common to, say, the average household, and to monitor how much the prices of that basket of goods is changing on a year-to-year basis. You throw it all together, that's CPI. Maybe your household experiences that CPI, maybe it doesn't, depends on your choices, but it's typical. Municipalities aren't houses, right? We have different pressures. We spend money on different things. Most people don't build roads, with their budget, right? Most people don't operate recreation facilities.
Exactly.
Most people don't have a large team of hired staff to deliver services. A couple of people do, most people don't. So the idea behind the municipal price index was to create an index that was specific to what municipal expenses look like and to do the same general thing. And in that first few years, it ended up being a little bit higher than CPI. Construction costs are a significant part. Fuel is a higher part. Some wage settlements were higher in that period. So it came in higher than CPI, but council kept to this municipal price index so that they could say they were keeping to an inflationary rate. And this was controversial.
But you know what? But Jeff, it's an inflationary rate specific to municipalities. I mean, if it came in at the same as CPI all the time, then what's the purpose, right? I mean, you would expect it not to come in the same as CPI.
Yeah, you would. And I think part of the critique of it was some folks saw it as self-serving because the city of Waterloo was creating it for the city of Waterloo. It wasn't created by some third party and it generally wasn't done anywhere else. And so that makes things suspect, especially if they're seen to be increasing taxes at a rate higher than CPI. And if the people think that CPI is the only possible number for tax increases.
Where does that come from, that general view?
You know, I think one of the challenges of, you know, the municipal budget setting process and property tax processes are that it's about the only cost you have in life that you feel that you get a vote on.
Yeah, true. Right?
Yeah. I guess you kind of do for the feds, but most of the stuff for the federal and provincial money is income tax based, right? It's about you earning more money. It's not about them changing the income tax rate and charging you more money. So it's not the same thing. But on the property tax rate, it's like, oh, they increase property taxes again. Well, it's because as the economy goes up and down, our revenue doesn't go up and down. It's based on this other thing. Yeah. Maybe it's not great, but it's what we got. People sort of have tension with that. And I think from what I've heard from folks, the idea seems to be if you're doing something above inflation, you are a net adder to my misery and pain from inflation. If you are at or below, then at least you're not making my problem worse. You're not making inflation higher. Or is it like there are a wide range of arguments.
Isn't driving over crappy roads adding to your problem in life too, your inconvenience in life, your uncomfortableness in life?
But that's a separate email. That's an email to complain about the state of the roads, not an email to complain about the state of the municipal budget.
Maybe Stats Can
should have related, been, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe Stats Can should have been retained to come out to work on this MPI concept.
I think that could have been interesting. But anyways, one of the things that we saw is limiting, because then in my first term of council, MPI took a dip. And there was a period of wage restraint in the public sector that was below inflation. And so all of a sudden we were getting less than inflation with MPI, and that created some pressures. Okay. And the other thing was, you know, when you constantly hold yourself to an inflationary budget, no matter how defined, inevitably there's going to be some stuff that gets left behind, right? Like we squeezed in a new fire station. We squeezed in a new library branch to inflation, even though those are massive increases in services and costs. Firefighters are not cheap. The trucks are cheap by comparison. You buy them once every 15 years.
Right.
But the firefighters you have every year do good work, not cheap. And trying to fit all that in to an inflationary tax increase crowds other things out. And that was the pressure we started facing. And I noticed in that first term on council was the city's getting bigger. We're getting new roads. We're getting new parks. But those departments aren't getting any more money to maintain any of that stuff. And people start to notice when the parks aren't getting maintained in the same level.
Or the hours are cut. So listen, Jeff, on the theme of crowding out, we're done.
Yeah. Talk about money for hours, but we have one.
Listen, thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate this opportunity to have this fulsome discussion on these issues. I know we could go on for more, and sometimes some people might think, oh, you did a whole show on that. But it was great. Thank you very much for the time and all the best.
No problem. There's a lot of fun in finance.
There is no fun in finance. There's fun in finance.
That's what I'm learning in my household.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Old Gray Mayors podcast. If you have any ideas for stories or people you would like us to interview or reach out to, please feel free to contact us. And thank you again.